Pat Rashford, and the name of my little discussion is Parents of Teens Anonymous. The reason for the title is simply because that's the name of the book that I'm currently writing. I have one chapter finished, and I'm working on chapters 2 and 3 this week up at Holden. Just a little explanation of how it came to be about. I'm a pediatric nurse, and I noticed a lot of really traumatic things happening with teenagers when they come into the clinic. And one of the things that impressed me most wasn't so much the teenagers had a lot of problems, but that the parents were really upset and sometimes just seemed very unable to handle the situation. Sometimes I take them aside, you know, kind of encourage them, and we talk a little bit about the problems that teenagers would have in general, and maybe I'd share something that one of my kids had done. And it seemed to make them feel better. So I decided I'd try writing a couple of articles, which I did, and they were a lot of fun to do. I did them in a humorous vein. One is called The Teen Evader, and that's dealing with communication. Like, I would love to communicate with my kid if I could find him. Or, like, this thing that says, "Have you hugged your kid today?" And my thing is, I would hug him if he'd let me. But most of the time, it's a turn-away kind of thing. He doesn't want anything to do with me. And that's really a frustrating kind of thing. And another article I wrote was Parents of Teens Unite. And out of those two, I was encouraged by the editor of Fleming and Revell to do a book, which I decided to entitle Parents of Teens Anonymous, taking the idea of help groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and putting them together as Parents of Teens. To give you an idea what the book is about, I'll share with you the proposal that I sent to the book company, and this should pretty well explain where I'm at with it. I might say, first of all, this is not a book to tell you how to raise your teenager or even how to get along with them, although it might help. Some of the things in it might help how to get along with them. What I'm really aiming at is support for parents and maintaining the sanity of the parent through the teenage years. According to recent statistics, about 80 to 85% of our children have been or will be in serious trouble sometime during their teenage years. That means only 15 to 20% will survive unharmed society's raging overuse and abuse of sex, drugs, alcohol, and violent crime. In our area earlier this year, a 15-year-old was one of several boys arrested for the brutal murder of a young woman. I cried for his parents. How frightened and guilty they must feel. His mother arrived in our clinic the next evening, pale, shaky, and drained of tears. She just needed something to help her sleep. Nationally, a young man shot our president. His parents, fine Christian people, never dreamed their son would be capable of such an act. The pain of a mother and father for a child in trouble is deeper and more unbearable than death, but it could happen to any one of us. Watching our kids grow up in our society is scary. Peers and unscrupulous adults make climbing the hill to maturity a rocky trip for both teens and their parents. Just when you think you've got them growing straight, they take a curve, blow it, and you're back to the bottle of Maalox, the Bible, and faith. For years, psychologists have been placing the blame on the kids' malfunction on the parents. Most of us accept our guilt without question. Some parents are coming out of the corner and daring to deny the accusations. It's not all my fault. Let the kid take responsibility for some of his own actions. I am tired of being the fall guy. PTA is for parents who feel guilty, depressed, and hurt. For those who want to unashamedly lift their heads and say, "Yes, I'm the parent of the teenager who burned down your mailbox. What do you think we ought to do with him?" It's for parents who watch too much television and actually believe in an ideal family. The only ideal family I've ever known got a divorce. Now they are real. They hurt. Someone can touch them. A person in trouble has to cry for help before another person can respond. PTA is being created to encourage parents to ask for support and give support in return. Bearing one another's burdens is a crucial message. PTA is not another How to Raise Kids book. It is an honest look at teenagers and their parents, their negatives and positives, their comedies and tragedies. It's a book to help parents muddle through the maze of their teenagers' misdirected energies and misguided emotions. PTA is a blend of tears and humor, true stories laced with sympathy, a little how-to interspersed with a few helpful hints and smothered in a lot of faith. For some of the things that I'm working on with this one is Confessions of a Parent, and I've worked through the guilt process of a parent pretty thoroughly. With my own kids, I felt a lot of guilt, and finally came to the conclusion that they were using my guilt against me, and it just wasn't making for very good relationships. I call guilt, in one section, the ultimate weapon in the wrong hands, which it really can be. I talk about getting rid of guilt and becoming a freed parent. I guess what I really wanted to have this session for today was to get some feedback on, do you feel that a support group for parents can be useful in your church, in your community, and how you feel about support, experiences that you've had with teenagers that you know, might make you feel that this kind of thing would be helpful. The book, for the most part, has a lot of humor in it, but it also turns around and points out some of the real trauma and tragedy in raising kids. It's not really geared for the person who is who has the really tragic events happening, because I do have a lot of humor, and I'm not sure that parents who've gone through real crisis can handle, you know, the humorous part of the book. But what I'd like is some feedback from you on, you know, if you think this sort of thing is valid, and if so, you know, why.
I think it's valid because it might save the lives of many parents. I think that many times, if you can just have someone to share experiences with, it makes you feel less abnormal or whatever. I think you can raise your children and you think that it's only my kids who do that. Only my kids who behave that way. And even if you can have someone else say, you know, that's really quite a normal behavior for that period of your life. That in itself, I think, is very helpful.
Right. Yeah. Do you find that in churches or in Christian groups that may be more of a problem than outside, where we might be afraid to, you know, to appear more vulnerable or something other than an ideal family?
I'm not sure.
how does the guilt thing, how do you feel about guilt? Do any of you have these feelings of when your kid is unhappy or gets into trouble, do you take that on as being your responsibility?
Their responsibility.
That's a good attitude. Right.
You are a parent, you have done certain things, and you feel certain things are expectations of you as parents. Likewise, children also have responsibilities and expectations which they must fulfill. They right. must, and I firmly believe that that's part of teaching them responsibility.
Mm-hmm. It isn't something that's quite that easily approached, though, in that attitude. Because one of the first problems you have is an embarrassment to yourself, mm-hmm. along with the guilt. And I think we as parents try to do everything that we possibly can to lead them down the path. And I think it's a natural human aspect that when something happens that we, or I, feel I'm partially to blame because someone I may have slipped, chances are it may not be true. But I think that's a normal thing. I just don't think the majority of parents, I know I couldn't, say, well, you know, tough, you have to rough it out for yourself. I didn't come from that kind of family, and I just don't think it would be easy for me. I think many parents can accept that. For me, the initial one is an embarrassment. I'm embarrassed by what the end of my child did. And then, along with the rest.
Yeah, I go along with that. My kids aren't quite teenagers yet, but I've noticed that other kids who aren't my own can be doing certain behavior, and it won't bother me a bit, you know. But if my own kids do that same thing, and I'm afraid that other people might be disapproving, then I'm really very uncomfortable about it. Mm-hmm.
Does it make you feel better when you know that other people who are Christians and that, you know, have gone through the same kinds of things with their kids?
Yeah, I think it should. I don't think about that too much, though. I think mostly I'm just feeling that embarrassment that you mentioned, mm-hmm. that my children aren't being perfect. And yeah. other kids can be not perfect, and it doesn't
right.
bother me in the slightest, but if my own aren't, then...
It's a personal affront.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's a very personal affront when your own kid is, you know, misbehaves, because I think one of those, one of the reasons behind that is you've raised this kid, and hopefully you can take pride in the way they're acting. And when they do something totally out of context, that's a hard pill to swallow. That is really tough.
It's your own pride.
Yeah.
But then the parent really is not responsible for that child's choosing to act that way.
That's true.
And the sooner the child realizes, I'm responsible for the way I act. That's easy to say, but I mean what everyone else.
Yeah. Well, this is what I really covered pretty thoroughly in the first chapter of PTA is the guilt problem and dealing with it. I'm trying to use some biblical verses to help in that. It's a complex kind of a situation, but I think we need to approach it lightly and to realize that there's a point where we don't really have any control over what our kids do. And I think, too, God has to use our kids or to have them encounter certain problems to teach them lessons. You know, how did we get to where we are?
There's another aspect of guilt, too, that we've been talking about. The guilt for their actions, but right now, I think I'm experiencing more guilt, not toward other people, but guilty toward my child. What have I done to make her the kind of person that she is? She has very low self-worth, And what have I done? I have squelched her enough that she doesn't have a good feeling about herself. And that's the way my guilt's coming out. I guess sometimes I'm guilt. I feel angry with her, maybe more than guilt for the way she relates to other people.
But there are so many more outside of the influence on your child once they enter school.
I think there's one thing that parents have to realize is that they're not the only thing that's affecting their child.
Right.
You know, especially when you're getting through the teen years, your peers are probably the most important thing to you. And parents don't often have that much effect on you. You know, but parents take, I think, a lot more responsibility
than they really should.
Really is theirs.
Yeah. The parents take a lot of the responsibility because they're told from so many sources that it's their fault.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is one thing I really would love to see us get away from, is absorbing so much of the fault. And there was in McCall's magazine, I believe, a quote from a college student who put all of the blame directly on parents. It is not the fault of the clergy. It is not the fault of the peers. You know, when the child misbehaves, it is the fault of the parent, period. So, you know, this is the kind of thing we have to live with, and I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's valid. And another aspect of the guilt thing is that kids really know how to use your guilt, and they'll turn on you with it. if they get the chance and they know that it's bothering you, certain things are bothering you. My son is exceptional at that. He knows what makes me feel guilty, and it doesn't bother him a bit to use it. Does anyone else ever get that feeling that your kids know, you know, just how to get to you?
Do you associate guilty with a negative feeling?
With a negative feeling? I think in this instance it's a rather negative feeling, because it doesn't really do any good. It doesn't help you unless you can get rid of it and start looking at a positive side of things. Do you see guilt as being positive?
No, I definitely feel it's negative in an adult.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I really emphasize is getting rid of the guilt. If not altogether stamping it out, at least sweeping it under the carpet for a while until you can get yourself together to where you're not, you know, feeling so bad about it. One of the things I really stress is positive thinking. And in the second chapter, which I'm working on now, one of the things is rejoicing always. And we get that message, although that's not quite an easy thing to do. It's something that comes with the Holy Spirit in you. The other thing is the Philippians 4:8, whatever is good, whatever is right. That's the, you know, the positive thinking, power of positive thinking in the Bible. That is one of the main dwelling points. And what I try to do is look at all the positive things that my kids do. Whenever they do anything that really impresses me, or even if Dave just walks by me in the hall and doesn't sneer at me, I write it down. Anything that improves the situation. You know, those are the things that I look back at now. If he really blows it and he's totally unreasonable and hostile, I go back and I look at the things that he's done that are good, and then it makes it, you know, a little bit easier to take. But that's just one of the things that I'm, you know, trying to deal with in the book.
When you mentioned rejoicing and accentuating the positive, we've had some pretty tough times with our little one. And
in tying this in with your idea of a parent support group, we have friends who just happen to be childless, and maybe that's why their perspective was so good, because in this last year, they've taught us how to laugh again at a time when we were really struggling, almost bottomed out as parents. And being able to laugh again through their eyes and with them gave us that support we need, that we're back together again and can carry on.
Yeah. Laughter is really important. Part that's one of the basic tools for living with teenagers that I have in my second chapter. In fact, I've got like 5 or 6 pages on humor, and then everything else is about 1 or 2 pages. And I'm wondering, feeling a little lopsided. But I feel like I just can't stress enough the humor. It's so important in the in dealing with kids. Not just to have humor yourself, but to try to instill it in the kids. And laughter does so much to help improve relationships.
I think we can be grim 95% of the time if we want to in some situations.
Oh, yeah.
And it just takes a very specific effort to laugh and to enable them to laugh too, not only at themselves but at our reactions as parents.
Yeah,
I think we need to laugh at that sometimes too.
But the teenager's sense of humor is so different from
yes. Right, that's very true.
I like your comparison, you know, you cited a couple who were childless. You can relate that to like to a farmer or an orchardist. When you're working with something like that, the farm, when I was involved in the farming, I knew which trees were bad and I didn't like them. Yet other friends would come by and describe how beautiful the orchard happened to be. I saw one particular frog, mm-hmm. yet the other individual saw the entire group.
That's a really good point. Yeah. You see your kids, and I think you tend to look at them too much, and you see all this stuff that the negative traits, and I think so much of the time we look at these traits and we see similarities in our own, mm-hmm. and I don't like that. that's a toughie for me. I just in my son, particularly, I see things that personality-wise that I have bad habits that I have, and it's like a thorn in the flesh.
When I was a teenager myself, I got kind of exasperated with my mother because I think she felt her role was first of all to be teacher and to be the molder and the one who was bringing up, and you know, felt the burden of parenting very heavily and so on. And I wished so often that she would just relax and be a person with us. And I can see myself going in the same role that she took. You know, it's very difficult sometimes just to have fun and be a person with your children, and not always to be the one who's bringing up so I think that's important too, that we can just be people with our children as well as the parents.
Yeah, be authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. How do you feel about showing your kids your anger or your tears, as well as the laughter and your sense of humor?
I think you have to.
If you don't show that, what does the child then know? What is his maximum barrier, which he can push you to? If you don't, how would you display it? You can display a firmness, but there are things sometimes when, you know, anger grips you, I should say. But I think there are times when that may be necessary under specific situations to display an anger that they know they have definitely gone way beyond the acceptable bounds of which they have been out for. Particularly if they challenge you so many times. And, mm-hmm.
It seems to me it isn't so much your kids, although they make you feel guilty, it's a society that all the books and so forth on how to raise kids properly and all the advice that you get. You never see any books written for the kids where they can learn how to relate to their parents. I think that'd be interesting.
Yeah, how to raise good parents.
Here's your next book.
That might be a good book. Yeah, that's right.
Something that, a 12-year-old would go out and buy. You know, that'd be something.
Especially since we usually become what our parents were. Mm-hmm. I think what the point that you said, just in the limited experience I had working with children, the things that I vowed I would never become, when you get angry or when, you know, it's been a long day, those are the things that start coming out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and because that's the form of discipline, or that's the form of even of caring that you have learned to learn. So therefore,
That was an interesting comment. One of my statements is to. Imagine their surprise when they wake up one morning and discover they are one of us. Ultimately, they will be, but at the time that they're going through the teen years, they, you know, have really no conception. The other thing is they don't have the market on trauma or, you know, tragedy or pain or tears. And I think that kids need to realize that they're not the only ones that have troubles. I think it's good to let your kids know that. And that's another thing I hope to bring out is in the authenticity is that parents need to let their kids know that they're not the only ones suffering or having a problem.
Pat, did you clarify between 13 and 19 the difference?
The difference?
They're all teen.
Yeah.
But
oh, there's a vast difference in...
There's a vast difference in how a parent would treat an 18 or 19-year-old who is away at college they treat the 13, 14-year-old who's in junior high. But they are all teenagers, according to that term that you've used. But I think there's a real split.
That's true.
I think once the child is then, quote, gone off to school or is no longer under the media roof every night, I think at that point then the umbilical cord would have had to have been separated and the child is on his own. But you can't, the end of teenager, you hope that time that the standards that he or she goes by have been well set, because if they haven't, there's no way that I or you or anyone else as a parent is going to change it.
I understand there's a number of parents, though, that have been dismayed to find that at that point that isn't necessarily the case.
The kids glue it back together.
That's one thing on the Dobson series that I remember, though. He stressed that by the time they're 18, they're adults.
Mm-hmm. And they're not only, as far as we're concerned, by the courts, they are adults, too.
I had a neat experience of being on my seventh teenager, and I was survived. I was survived.
You look pretty good.
And I've done it all wrong, but I've come out according to the books. But the result, bad. If you've done your best.
That's a real key. If you've done your best.
More can you do?
I don't think God really expects us to do more than our best.
I'm of the generation where you married and had children and stayed at home, and you know, this was it. And I did the very best I could, and it was a full-time job, and I found it satisfying, and now I've only got a 15-year-old left.
How did you deal with the authorities, quote, like the Dr. Spock and some of those, or you don't play the hands of the child? And
the first two we beat to a pulp. Didn't do any good. Two boys 14 months apart, you get into everything. The next two, kind of, you know, laid back over. You were as bad as the ones we beat. But we tried it all. But we did try. And we were concerned. And we did all that we, and we did well. that all lied, that all stole. One of them called me in a talk that she gave to teenagers at a church group. She said, my mother was a pusher. She pushed us to go to church. Every way. And they fought the religious education and the involvement. And that still is a big hang-up. And I pulled out the German authoritarian attitude. So help me, as long as you are living at home under our roof, that on Sundays it's expected that you go to church. You have a choice of which service. And when you go away from home, you will have to make your own choice. But if you come home to visit at Christmas or Easter on the holidays, you know, do expect to go to church, because I am not going to go and say, he is sleeping in bed.
Now that they're adults, are they having, making a choice to go to church?
They've made neat choices. Some do not go to church at all. And the baptism of the grandchild, I'm sure, is just for the parental approval. Some, one has turned Roman Catholic and is extremely involved. Mm-hmm. And maybe two or three are very much involved as adults in the church in which they are raised. Those of that who are still in college are, you know, as they do in college, one went to Oregon by himself to establish residency and was very lonesome and knew no one. And on a very homesick call at age 19, I said, why didn't you try church? Oh, he said, mother, that's not my problem. And I said, well, if the pastor is any kind of a guy, he'll realize that you're lonesome. You don't know anybody. He might ask you for Sunday night supper. It took him a few weeks to do it, but he did do it, and he got very much involved. And was involved with the youth group, was involved with the local parish priest who really invited him for dinner, and it did take off. And then I'm still pushing the teenager. Gotta go. And I have no idea where I'm going to end up. I'm doing the best I can.
Right.
I like, we had Tom Householder come to our church. And I remember so clearly his statement that he's a young man, but he clings to the promise in Proverbs that if you train up a child in the way he should go, he will not depart from it. And he said, they might depart from it for a time, but he really believes that a parent who has trained up their child and has prayed for that child's salvation will eventually come back. He says sometimes parents don't see it.
In terms of encouraging youth to teens to go to church, as someone involved with youth in junior high and senior high, and seeing so many youth not coming after confirmation, I appreciate that firm encouragement. I know in my own high school days, after my confirmation, all through my childhood, it was expected that we go to church. As a matter of fact, it was so expected we didn't even have to ask. Our dad basically, I was close to the bathroom, thank goodness. I remember pushing my feet out over the bed, sitting me up and expecting me to just be in the car in 15 minutes, and it always happened. And now it's just almost every Sunday morning. I expect it to happen, but it doesn't. But it happens anyway. And as a youth director, and seeing that cutoff of confirmation, where parents all of a sudden say, since he or she is confirmed, we don't have to do anything else because we fulfilled our obligation. I say, no way. They're still in your home. You still have a responsibility to encourage them. I appreciate that.
I appreciate hearing you say that. I've seen so many instances of people that are really devout Christians, their children not coming to church. And, you know, I just haven't been able, because that would be my slant. I would feel that I had that right to
be authoritarian in that sense and say, no, you will go to church. But sometimes you're insecure about your decisions and you're thinking, oh, am I making the right decision? I mean, we don't have that problem right now because he's just turned 13. But, you know, I wonder about it happening later on and wondering, gee, is that the right thing to do? If you push them, then are they going to reject it forever when they're older and this sort of thing? So I've appreciated hearing this.
I think the trick is to know when one doesn't necessarily have to push if you're going along with them. And
right,
also
it's just
being
an assumption in our house, you know.
Yeah.
There isn't any, but he's young yet, so I haven't known if that would ever happen. I pray that it doesn't happen.
Yeah. I think where it doesn't happen is when the kids get pulled out of bed and get dropped off.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Or that's the type of thing that I see as being...
Or especially, too, if one parent goes. I think that can be very negative. So often you see this with the mother going and not the father, and then if the child is a boy, so frequently we'll take that.
Yeah, that brings to mind one family in our church where the mother is right now thinking of divorcing the husband, and I've been with the son quite a bit, but he's during the summer... He's basically with his father off working construction, and during the year with his mother. And it seems as though right now his father is winning out,
mm-hmm.
and the son is losing interest very fast. Even though he knows that, even though he's had a wonderful time at church and has learned a lot, and there is a lot of influence there.
I think that parents have to realize that maybe their kids will stop going to church, but that I think when something really happens, you know, they always know that they have that to turn to. You know, they still always have that memory, hopefully, of what it meant, and hopefully that memory isn't bad. But, you know, they've still always had that experience. I mean, someone who's never gone to church probably isn't going to think of turning to one, but someone who has, you know, still always has that alternative. And I think, too, that with the thing about confirmation, sometimes parents want to give their kids the impression that, yes, we totally trust you and you can do whatever you want. But sometimes they take it too far and they give the kids the impression that, well, we don't really care what you do. You know, just do whatever you want to do. It doesn't matter to us. And kids don't like that either because then they don't feel loved and cared for. You know, you need to have... your parents showing you that they care what you do, and you know sometimes that has to take that kind of authoritative thing. Because kids might resent it, but at least they know that their parents, you know, care what they do, and that's important.
Mm-hmm. I've got a section where I talk about "Hug Me, It's Good for You" is the title, and I went through a time with my son where he just shun me. You know, he didn't want me to hug him or kiss him anymore. And I decided that was not the way it was going to be. and I have continued to hug him. And for a while, it was just sort of a, you know, he'd stand there like this. And once in a while, he hugs me back. But I continue because I want him to know that I love him, and I kind of figure no matter what happens, no matter what kind of reaction you get or what kind of negative things go on, as long as you constantly and consistently say I love you and hug them, you know, they're either going to think one of two things. They're either going to think that you really do love them or that you're... illiterate and can't say anything else.
You know, I think it's real interesting, this business about trusting. You know, we're always, we don't want to tell the teenagers that we don't trust them. I read something the other day about, you know, if we're really honest, we don't always trust ourselves with some things, you know. So we should be honest and tell our kids that, no, we don't trust them. That's why we want them back at a certain time, or we don't think they ought to do this or the other thing. There's necessarily, I mean, we're at least we should be honest. Come out and say that we don't trust them at times. I think there's anything wrong in not trusting.
I don't know about that. I was just I was just talking with my father not too long ago, and I've got a younger sister who just finished ninth grade, and she's the eighth child in our family, and so I consider my dad kind of good at this. And it's been interesting watching my younger sister grow up, because at times I've wanted to just wring her neck, and my parents will just sit back and handle it in their own way. And there was one time in particular that Chrissy really abused my parents' trust. And Dad sat her down and talked with her and said, and this would happen to be on a Saturday evening, so he said, go to bed. You got church in the morning. Put a plug in there. I was talking to him saying, you know, you must have known that we all got away with murder. And he said, yeah, but I'm glad that you didn't know that I knew then. There were times when I would turn my back, that I had my expectations high, and I may not have trusted you all the time, but it was important to me, this is what he said, it's important to me that you knew that I trusted you, because I knew that was the only thing that kept you from going absolutely nuts. That trust level is important. When I see kids, and I worked at a youth recreation center last year for what they call potential delinquents. 80 to 90% of the kids have been in trouble with the law. There, the parents were always mistrusting the kids. They were always looking for them, or else they weren't there at all. There was no trust at all in the kids. They didn't expect anything, and boy, then they really lived up to those expectations. I think
it might be a semantical thing a little bit. You gotta determine exactly what trust is now, because you know if you have an alcoholic, if you have a tendency toward being an alcoholic, shall we say, you can't always trust yourself around alcohol. To be perfectly honest, you know, if you can't trust yourself all the time, you can't trust other people all the time either. You know, there's a certain stage, of course, we have to put limits on what the kids do at different ages. And, I mean, are we talking about, if we say that not to cross the street or to be careful crossing the street or whatever, are we implying that we don't trust them, or are we just concerned? So it gets kind of difficult to define, I think.
I know in my own experience, so I can really relate to what he's saying, because my father trusted me implicitly and made a great point of telling me that. And there was no way I was going to disappoint him, because, I mean, it was very clever of him. I mean, I feel, looking back, I don't think he purposely played on my guilt. But I think that's the effect that it had, you know, that I would have felt terribly guilty if I'd done anything wrong, because he just said, dear, I just trust you, and I just think you know, he just thought I was wonderful. And
did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes.
That didn't quite have that same level of trust?
Well, no. my sister, he did the same thing with, and my brother was older when he married my mother. He was my stepfather. And my own father died when I was young, so, you know, I didn't have that influence from him. But looking back, I just can't get over how clever that was, you know. And I don't think, like I said, I don't think he really...
Did he ever say, come in at 10 o'clock?
It was more, my mother was the one that was concerned.
So your mother.
And I felt very angry. No, he was the one, looking back, I think it was his influence that kept me so straight. But my mother, I can remember just one instance of being very angry with her for not trusting me. And all of that just absolutely just made me madder than anything. Yeah, I couldn't stand that. So I think it's important that...
When you're a teenager, a lot of times you feel like more like an adult than a kid. You know, you want to be treated that way.
Right.
And when people don't trust you, you know, I think you just tend to do it then out of spite. A lot of times.
Well, it implies that you don't have the sense to make
yeah.
a decision for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at that age, I guess you're feeling like you're responsible for your own life. I think that's what I felt.
To me, that's love, though. You didn't want to let him down.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's what it was.
I can remember just positively, totally betraying the trust that my parents had in me. And having them pick up the pieces at a time when self-image, self-confidence, and everything in myself were shot, when I realized what kind of betrayal I had committed. And then watching them just completely, after picking up these pieces, put that trust back and saying, we're ready to go. Are you ready to go? Can you go? And because of that, I was able to. And I think that's a really difficult thing to do as a parent.
I think that's a real key right there. I think trust, and I realize when I'm speaking here, I'm speaking now as a parent, and probably I've done it. But I remember when I saw that my little sister had totally, as you say, betrayed their trust. She was absolutely crushed. She was crying, and I was sitting with her for a little bit, and she was saying, Mom and Dad are going to be so disappointed, I won't be able to look at them. Because I had to call them and tell them about something. And when Mom and Dad came home, it took a long time to mend that, because it was something that really hurt Chris, and it hurt Mom and Dad. But then to put that trust back in place and say, okay, this is a given, this is behind us, I still love you, and let's go from here.
But that's what God does for us.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
You know what crosses my mind just as we're talking about this is the fact that we're each individuals, and we have brought into our marriage and into our family and our childbearing the experiences that we had as children. And even though we go to discussions and we read books and we try to improve ourselves, it still doesn't take away from the fact that we're the people that we are. And I can't raise my children or be the person that Pat is, because I'm not that kind of person, and I can't raise my kids that way. So maybe what we're saying is, I don't know what I'm trying to get at.
It's okay to be yourself.
But it's okay that, like Ron lets his kids know that there are times that he doesn't trust them, because he's that kind of person. But for your father and for your family, that style of child raising worked for them.
Wouldn't it be possible then too that, because your children are individuals, a different style would be, you have to be consistent to an extent, but for one child, maybe coming right out and saying, I don't trust you, would be effective, whereas for another one of your children, it wouldn't have the same effect.
I think so. Yeah, that's really valid. Kids are so different. Yeah.
You run into trouble with that, though, sometimes. Because
like I said, there's an element of consistency there, because you remember what your brother's got and didn't get.
Because I remember my sister wanting to go to a dance when she was about 14, and my mom said, no way, you know, you're not going. And she said, well, Kayla went, you know, why can't I? You know, and it's that thing of, well, why did they trust her and not me? You know, you feel like you're being persecuted or something, you know.
I think the area of trust, though, is different for each child, and I think the important thing is that you don't put the child in the frame of mind that you don't trust him to do everything that he's doing. I think there are specific times when, and you have to say, I know with our boy, in a particular case, he said, well, don't you trust me? I said, well, you've demonstrated to me that I can at this point on that item.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it is that I don't trust him over the entire area, but there was one particular item. And he knew he was wrong. He knew that he had valid, that what he told me was the fact. And then I informed him, you know, that particular area, I can't trust you at this point until you can demonstrate to me and reinstill my trust back in you for that one item.
See, I think it's important that parents tell their kids the reasons why they feel the way they do, because then there's room for a dialogue back and forth, and kids feel like, okay, I'm being related to as an adult. They're giving me their reasons why, you know, and I can reply with mine, kind of thing. And they, at least, you know, they know what's going on. And they feel treated on a higher level. You know, they're just saying, no, you can't, and that's it, and no discussion. Kind of thing.
I think then you're building the basis, too, for treating for them being responsible for the behavior. You know, you've demonstrated this. Therefore, you know, you were the one who chose to not have my trust.
And you can get back that favor by.
You chose to have these consequences. But it's not over. You know, you can still grow into it.
Do you ever say, I trust you, but I don't trust your friends?
Oh, you say that, you know, under this particular case, I have some concern, and then you were right, we have a problem on the phone. And you say, look, you know the problem with the other individual, and it's going to present a serious temptation to you. And I have faith in you, but you have to keep that in mind. The outside, well, as you say, peer pressure in junior high, it wipes them out.
You know, a lot of times I tell my kids that it's not that I don't necessarily trust them in situations, it's that I don't trust the situation or maybe the people that they're going to be with. It's like my son wants to go to a rock concert, you know. I'm not too crazy about that. And it's not that I don't necessarily trust him, although I do have a little bit of, you know, is he going to make it through it? It's that I don't trust the whole system, the way the whole rock concert is set up, the influences within that concert.
Of course, it really applies to the movies, too, nowadays.
I think when you start talking about a kid's friend, I mean, I remember my mom disapproving of one of the friends that I had, and I just got really defensive, because in a way, she might be attacking my friend, but she's indirectly attacking me, because of my choice. Right, and so you right away rally to their defense, you know, and maybe you were thinking of, well, maybe I shouldn't hang around with that friend. But you don't really want to prove your parents right, you know, so you kind of stick with them a little bit longer. I mean, you know, it turned out my mother was completely right, but I also found that out on my own eventually, you know. And if I would have listened to her, I maybe would have spared myself some pain, but at least I learned.
Well, that brings up a good point. See, that's the paradox that parents are in. I mean, at what point do they feel like, should we bring it up or should we not, you see? Mm-hmm. So when you get to be a parent of a teenager, then you're confronted with those difficult situations. I mean, you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't.
You really love your kids.
How did you
handle the trust?
Well, I'm going to tell you, the car business is the biggest because they would share the use of my car. Did I trust them? But I did not put in earplugs. I did not put on blinders. I wanted to know where they were going, when they were going to be home, who they were with, and what they intended to do. And they knew that I would check up on them if I...
Did they ever ask you when you asked those things, well, don't you trust
so
me?
I did look at the odometer. I did wake up to see if they were... They came into my car, but I am not going to ignore those other things. Because that car is my responsibility and theirs when they are using it. And I can come to them, if necessary, and say, where did you go? What time did you come home? I know, because I did check up. You did. And then they know that they didn't put one over on me.
How would you like an 11 and 15-year-old on loan for a while?
I had a 15-year-old. I'm from the Midwest.
I said, how would you like an 11 and a 15-year-old on loan for a while?
I don't always come out of it. But I'm a 15-year-old who's working in the orchard in Wenatchee for the summer, and it's the nicest thing that ever happened to me.
What she's got is a good feeling about herself, and that's important.
He can't drive. His friends at home are, I just told him, sitting on a powder keg. They're curious about girls, smoking, booze. We live in a college town. There are no jobs. After the college kids and the high school kids have them, there's no room for a 15-year-old.
They're rebellious, a little bit. They're terribly curious, and they're B-O-R-E-D. And I cannot give him enough to keep him straight for 3 months in the summer. But the Orchard at minimum wage can. And I'm delighted because he went to the Orchard as a young boy. I am sure he's going to come home entirely changed.
I was reading this recently. This is a new phenomenon in just the last few decades. They didn't used to have a teenage problem because they either worked on the farm or they were the father was in some kind of trade. And generally, kids were more, they didn't have the education situation they have now where they were dependent for so many years.
There was one major thing that they had, because I can relate back to my experience. When I was 8, I did things at year 8 from the standpoint of team horses and everything that I would, and under some conditions, be hesitant to give my boy 15.
That was the point.
Do you mean you would because of trust or because you felt it was too hard or what?
No, well, some too hard, but some the fear, you know, that well, he may get hurt or something may mishap with my dad or my folks. I had been around him all the time and I knew exactly what had to be done. And it just turned over. It was a trust level that they had in me that my dad could turn the team and more over to me. And a great dangerous piece of equipment. I didn't have it. I knew what I had to do.
Well, but he might have had a greater need, too.
Only a minor part of it. It was a very minor part. Yeah. But it's just something that I...
So do you feel you trust him?
I want to interrupt just for a second. It's about 5 minutes till, and the dinner bell will be ringing in about 5 minutes. So if you're wanting to go to the first dinner, just thought I'd warn you. Go ahead.
Back to what Ron was saying, though, that's right, because I've heard recently, too, in civilizations, in the more backward countries, I guess is one way of saying it. There isn't a teenage problem because they're all busy.
They're too busy to worry about all these traumatic experiences happening to them. And, you know, they've got too much time to look at themselves and say, you know, who am I, where am I, what am I going to do, why is this happening to me?
Like a boy-girl situation, you know, 100 years ago, the average marriage age was considerably lower.
Mm-hmm. We've just extended adolescent.
We've made our own monsters.
Yeah.
Now we have to live with
them. But then we hear too that they're maturing so much younger. Dobson says 3 years younger, the things that were in high school are maturity level is down to junior high, and even in some cases it's 5 years younger, so it's in the elementary.
That may be physically, but emotionally I don't think that's the case at all. I think emotionally, I think people were mature because of the requirements in the last century. I think the average 15-year-old generally was had a lot of responsibilities and he didn't have the time. Generally, he wasn't going on in his education. Quite often, it was the eighth grade or something like that because he was needed in the trade or the farm or something. So he may not have been, I don't know whether he was just physically mature. Maybe that's, I think, what they're talking about. I think emotionally and responsibilities, you know.
Well, he was also talking about the things that are happening, like the things that were the drug problems and the alcoholic problems are down in the junior
high. Yeah.
But also physically.
I'd like to ask Peter a question, or Roger a question. In your dealing with the youth, do you get certain, signals from them as to the influence that their parents have had and the pressure that their parents have had in this area of making sure that you do go to church? If you look at that group who, where the parents attended with the child versus that group who either one parent or the child was dumped off, you see differences in those two?
Okay, out of just pure numbers, out of possible 300 youth between the ages of grade 7 through 12, we've probably got 60 that are active. And I would say just generally that those whose parents participate equally are there. And I think that almost corresponds to the membership and then the Sunday participation in general in the whole congregation. I understand around 32% of our congregation attend on any given Sunday, and I guess that's pretty much average.